I had a great time last night reading a terrific new book. It's called Hello, Lied the Agent. It is the inside story of what it's like to be a sitcom writer, a TV writer in Hollywood here at the beginning of the 21st century. It was written by Ian Gervitz. And I so enjoyed the book that I said, let's get this guy on the show and talk about this a little bit. Ian has worked on shows like Wings and Becker, written episodes of Frasier and The Wonder Years and Get a Life and others. And so he joins us here this afternoon on KMOX. Hi, Ian. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Good. Nice job on the book.
Thanks very much.
Did you write any Wonder Years episodes with Winnie Cooper in them?
Yeah, I think she was in the one I wrote. It had to do with baseball. It was a long time ago. I think it was called The Unnatural or something like that.
Anything with Winnie was a good episode of Wonder Years, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
Did you write the book for people like me who are not in the television industry but are always curious about it, or did you write it for people who want to be in the industry and want to be writers to answer their questions about how to do what you do for a living?
A little bit of everything. I started writing it just out of pure frustration, plus the questions you get from people about what it's like. And sort of the frustration in TV development just grew into explaining how things work, because most people you meet really just don't have an idea of how the business actually works out here.
Right.
And how frustrating it can be.
Yeah.
So as I sort of spewed on paper and into the computer, over time I said, well, I should clarify this, I should clarify that, and suddenly parts of it serve that purpose, to just explain to people what it's like.
My dad, who was a high school teacher, wrote 10 books, all nonfiction, all aimed at the young adult market. But because people found out that he had written some books, they were constantly coming up to him and saying, oh, I have a great idea for a book. All you have to do is write it.
Yeah, exactly.
Do people do that to you?
Constantly. That's one of the things I mention in the book, because most people think that if you just hand over your idea, well, that should be worth something. But the fact is, out here, mostly ideas are sort of worthless. Everything is execution. You'll see the same idea 100 times. It's pitched thousands of times. It's how it's done. You know, it's the difference between Lost and Gilligan's Island.
It also becomes, you know, an idea apparently gets out there. And I don't know how this happens. You can explain this to me. How does an idea get out there, and instead of becoming one TV show, it becomes three TV shows, all the same idea?
Well, sometimes it's just, you know, something that's in the air and people are pitching similar things. I mean, it happens. The other thing is, if a show works, you're going to get people who go, let's copy that.
But sometimes they come on the air at the same time. It's like those body switch movies.
Exactly. I noted that in the book. There were four of them pretty much at the same time between 87 and 88, but only Big, to me, got it right.
Right.
The other ones were sort of silly. I mean, right now I know two identical shows. One, I think, is on CBS. And one is on Fox. Same exact show.
Or how about NBC, which is going to have two behind-the-scenes shows about Saturday Night Live on in the same season?
Right, but then, you know, you've got Tina Fey behind one and Aaron Sorkin behind the other. So, I mean, one of the rules in Hollywood is you never do shows about show business, because the assumption is that nobody knows or nobody cares.
Well, here you are writing about the inside of the industry. Are you telling me that the TV industry shouldn't do shows about TV?
Not at all. I think it's interesting. Again, to me, it's all execution. You can do a show about anything if you do it well. It's well written and well produced. But the reason these two shows are on, both of which sort of break one of the little rules that you hear out here, never do stuff about show business, is that you have very strong producers behind each one.
You have worked on some pretty big hit shows. You know, Wings was on for several years. Becker was on for several years. Those are considered hits in Hollywood.
I think they're considered successes. I don't think they ever graduated to hits.
Oh, what's the difference?
A hit is Frasier. A hit is Raymond. A hit is Seinfeld. Something that everybody, you know, it made a fortune in syndication. Sort of one of those water cooler shows. Becker and Wings were both sort of nice little successes that went on, and they're both running in syndication, but it's just sort of a not quite hit status.
Does working on a, quote, nice little success guarantee you another job?
Nothing guarantees anything. I had a development deal post-Becker, which is sort of the genesis for this book, and all it did was get me in the door. I wrote a few more pilots, none of which went, so then you're just flying solo.
What is a development deal?
Where you get a contract with the studio for a year, usually two, for a certain amount of money, and you get an office and an assistant and an expense account and an obscene salary, and you just sit and come up with as many ideas as you can. You try to pitch them and try to sell them and hope they get made and on the air.
I got to tell you, Ian, for a lot of Americans, that would qualify as another job.
It is a great job, but it's amazing how quickly 2 years can pass. And when you walk in, you can put your feet on the desk and go, this is very cozy. And some people just, you know, go play golf three times a week. But 2 years can pass in a heartbeat, in a heartbeat. Next thing you know, you're sort of driving off the studio going, it didn't work. But save the money.
And if you don't come up with a new success in those 2 years, are you blackballed?
Not at all. Nobody's ever blackballed, really. You just you go off and do it on your own, like I did. I went home, set up an office at home, and did it by myself.
There are people saying we're now in a golden age of television, another golden age of television. You know, I guess, they said it in the 50s, they said it in the 80s. Now, you hear this, TV critics are calling this because of some hot dramas that are on the air now, that this is another golden age of television. Do you disagree?
I don't really see it. It doesn't feel very golden to me. Every time I turn on the TV, it's a lot more Fear Factors and a lot more cop shows and a lot more explosions. You look back at something like The Twilight Zone, shows like that. If I saw another one of those, then I would agree more that it's more of a golden age.
You don't think of an era of The Sopranos and 24 Soprano, and Lost and those things?
I like 24. I like Lost. The Sopranos is brilliant, but it's on cable. That, to me, is where the golden age of TV is happening.
Does it also offer better opportunities?
Cable, there are opportunities there. Oh, there's also a lot of people who have the same idea. Let's pitch the cable because you get frustrated working on the network side, and cable allows a lot more freedom. So it's very appealing to writers both in, half-hour sitcoms or in hour-long shows. But, of course, the competition is pretty stiff also.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with Ian Gervitz, Hollywood TV writer. His brand-new book is called Hello, Lied the Agent. What does your agent think of the title?
He actually liked it. He laughed.
You mentioned reality shows, Fear Factor, and that sort of stuff. Are these the bane of a Hollywood writer's existence?
Depends on who's doing the writing. If you're working on one of these shows, they open up a lot of opportunity. If you're in the half-hour business, it's put a lot of people out of work, but it's just the nature of things right now. It'll probably cycle back in some time. There'll be a glut of reality shows. People will get tired of them. And then maybe other shows will come back. At various times in history, people have said half-hour TV is dead, then Cosby came along and suddenly it was alive again.
So, where are we now in that cycle?
In the cycle, reality is all over the map, and CSI and hour shows, and I think, like you said, a lot of the Lost and 24-style shows are around, a lot of medium kind of shows. There's a lot of cop stuff, a lot of crime, a lot of doctor shows like Grey's Anatomy. That's sort of what's going on right now. But, of course, I think because half hours are sort of looked at as dead, I hear that people are now really hungry for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Because these things are worth $1 billion in syndication.
Plus, if you discover the one that, quote, reinvents the genre, boom.
Yeah, you just don't see many people, at least I haven't seen many people on the network side, trying to reinvent it. More often than not, they seem to just flog old styles.
Take me a little bit, and I know the book goes into this extensively, but give me a little short primer here on how difficult it is to get a 30-minute sitcom to get even on the air. Let's forget about a hit or, as you say, a moderate success, just to even get one on the air. How long and how hard is that process?
How long? Let's see. If you have something that you've been working on, say, in the spring, if you can get maybe to pitch it sometime in around now, actually, September, October. If you can sell it as a script and you deliver it sometime in December, early January, if it goes to pilot, if you're that lucky and the odds get whittled down a lot, you shoot it, say, you cast it in March, you shoot March or April and deliver. By May, you know if you're on the air. By June, you're in production. You can
all from that one script.
All from that one script again, but along the way, there are probably about of all the ideas that are pitched over, I would say thousands, 500 or so are commissioned for script. Maybe 125 or so are actually shot. Maybe 35 or so get on schedules either in the fall or mid-season. It gets whittled down to the point where by the following year, maybe there are two or three shows left.
Out of those hundreds that we started out with.
Hundreds. But what happens is as soon as, the fall schedule right now hasn't, it's starting and shows are premiering, but people are already pitching new shows.
Are there writers in Hollywood who make a living and never get a show on the air?
Yeah, absolutely. You can make a decent living writing pilots that never get shot. I had two friends in the movie business, worked for 10 years doing scripts, never had a thing made.
Does that get frustrating after a while, or do you look at it and go, okay, well, this is the industry I'm in?
Yeah, it got frustrating to them because they switched over to TV, and there's a little bit more immediate gratification. You write something, and you see it shot in a few weeks, and you can see it on the air in another month and a half. So your words actually go through.
I had a friend who was one of the early writers on The Simpsons. I guess he was there in like the third or fourth year, a guy by the name of David Stern.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him what it was like to be a writer on The Simpsons, and he said, a lot of people think that we all sit together in a room and make jokes, and somebody writes them down, and boom, that's a script. And he said, actually, it's me working on a script and then going in and being told by everybody else in that room that nothing I had on the piece of paper was funny, and they had funnier stuff.
Exactly.
Is that what it's like?
Sort of. You know, it's group work and individual work. You break stories as a group, you go off, and whoever's assigned that script writes the outline, gets notes, writes the first draft, gets notes, brings it in for a pre-table draft. Everybody goes around the room, and it gets dissected one line at a time, one joke at a time. That's just before you go to the table. Then there's a week of rehearsals. By the end of that week, if you've got 20 or 30% of what you actually wrote still alive, you're doing pretty well.
Wow.
But that's just...
You could have 80% of your script thrown out?
Thrown out, improved, punched sideways, changed, because 2 or 3 days in, people get bored with the joke, and let's just change that. So it's just the nature of the process. So even if you've been doing it a long time, I've stood out and outside the office at, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning during a rewrite, kicking my,
Yeah.
Whatever's around or whoever's around, because a joke I lost,
Right.
A joke I liked just got cut. So you, as much as you think you know how to deal with it, you never learn how to deal with it.
And when that joke gets cut, do you make a note to yourself, save that joke, I'll put it in the next one?
Yeah. I'll prove to you it's funny. Or you save it on stage for that night when the joke that was put in its place dies. You go, can we try this one? Sometimes you look like a fool, sometimes you look like a hero.
But at least that input is from creative people. What happens when the network suits get involved?
That can be the infuriating part, because they tend to come at it from a different point of view. It's a little less Socratic and a little bit more, let's just smooth every edge, don't take any chances, ooh, this joke's too mean, ooh, I don't like the way that makes them look. So it can be the death by a thousand cuts. But that'll happen more in a pilot than it will in an ongoing series. Once a series is up and running and it's doing well, people don't meddle with it because it's alive, so why screw with it?
Do they ever come to you from the network level and say, you can't make this joke about radishes. We just signed a big deal with the National Radish Board. You'll have to make it about celery?
Nah, I've never really seen that one. They're not really after you. It's not so much joke by joke. It's sort of story points, or people are coming off mean, or I didn't like the way she said that. Sometimes they'll be on stage and try to get you to give people line readings in the middle of a shoot.
And this is from the network people, not the people who are involved, the writers, producers, directors, and actors, but somebody else who sits in an office all day long and comes down and says, you got to change this. But everybody else on the show thought it was good. If they say that, it has to go?
You can fight some battles, but usually the clock is ticking. So what smart producers do is, I'll tell you what, I'll do it both ways and we'll sort it out later. You've got 300 people in an audience sitting there. Everybody's on the clock. The actors are looking to you going, what are we going to do? You say, you either argue them back or you say, I'll shoot it both ways. We'll figure it out later.
Can we safely say you're in the process of developing your next big success?
Actually, I'm pitching something with a couple of friends of mine and had some meetings canceled today, which is par for the course, but we should be doing it next week. And meanwhile, I just produced and wrote and directed a movie, just to make things interesting.
When is that going to come out?
I hope soon. I'm in editing on it right now. It's called L.A. Blues with Anthony Michael Hall and Dave Foley, and George Wendt from Cheers did a little cameo. So that was actually a lot of fun because I did it myself and had absolutely no interference.
Wow.
The whole way.
Does that mean you financed it?
Unfortunately, I broke the one big rule in Hollywood. Never put your own money in it.
Uh-huh.
But you know what? It paid... Paying the bills meant I had the freedom to do what I want.
Well, in that case, let's mention the name again, L.A. Blues.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's it about?
Basically sort of a diner kind of movie. You're in the lives of six guys who hang out in a bar and just sort of male friendship kind of thing.
That's what we would call a pitch right there.
Yeah. That is kind of a pitch. Yeah.
Do you go into people who you want to convince to hire you and say stuff like, well, it's kind of a diner kind of thing?
Yeah, that helps frame it for someone. You know, puts them in a world right from the start when you get before you get into the specifics. You know, you just say, this is the world we're in, sort of diner, swingers, sideways.
Mm-hmm.
And then they at least know what kind of movie you're talking about or TV show.
And when you're doing a TV show, since we're talking about sitcoms in particular, which you've worked on so much through the years, how important is casting?
Vital. It's absolutely vital. That is what I mean in terms of an idea. When it goes from just a basic idea to a script to execution, you cast the right person in something, it makes all the difference in the world. You miscast it, jokes fall flat. And the character just doesn't come alive.
When you're writing a new sitcom, something that you're developing, that you're hoping to get on the air, do you write it and think, okay, I'm writing this in so-and-so's voice, hoping that a certain person will be
that role? You write the character, and as well, you're thinking, if I could just get so-and-so, that would be great. If you start to hear a voice along the way, and it starts to sound like someone, you sort of write it with both things in mind, because the reality is the person you want, you're not going to be able to get them. You just accept that from the start.
Yeah. You want Ted Danson and you get Fred Danson instead.
Yeah, that's you know, Monday you're hoping for so-and-so, Friday you're on your knees to somebody else.
By the way, do you want Ted Danson? Is he a name you want your show?
I would kill to work with Ted again, but somebody else beat me to it. He's got a show, I think, on ABC this year. He plays a shrink.
And once you write it with someone's voice in your head and then it turns out not to be that person, do you then have to rewrite?
You may have to rewrite, you know, but it's also sometimes it can get you out of your own head. You hear one voice, and then someone else comes along with a different take, and for a day or so you grumble, and then when you stop and open your mind a little bit, you start hearing something else, and you go, that's even more interesting than what I thought.
Have you ever had any violent changes in casting? By that, I mean you wanted Ted Danson, but the network gave you Marky Post?
Not that I can think of. I mean, of the shows I did, when the process was underway, I was always working with a particular piece of talent. So then it was sort of casting the other players.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you get who you want or you're in love with someone and it's working out on Friday and it's dead on Monday. So you have to be very fluid in casting. I just learned that casting this movie. Went through a lot of people trying to make deals, trying to get everybody happy, and when it doesn't work out, you just gripe and then you let it go and you move on.
And I would guess, particularly when you're making a movie as opposed to a sitcom that may already be up and running, when you're making a movie and you want the character to be a certain kind of person and you can't get who you wanted and then somebody else becomes available but you think, it's not who I want here, you have to face that choice of, do I rewrite it for that person or do I just take somebody else? Even though he'd be good for it, I'm going to go with somebody else.
I think you're smarter to go with the better actor. If you try to cram someone into a part, I mean, at some point when you're in production in one of these things, you have to keep your mind open. You know, you hear your characters, but if someone walks through the door and does something that you just didn't see, you'd be a fool not to go, that's great.
Mm.
And the casting I got on this movie, the people were sensational. But in some of them, I had no idea they were going to walk through the door.
And while we're speaking about casting, have you had people want you to write stuff for them that you can't stand, but you took the job anyway?
But I took the job anyway. Never with someone I can't stand. I've had meetings with people, and they've pitched me their idea, and sometimes I did it. And sometimes I just said, you know what? I'm not the right person for you. I don't get this.
Uh-huh.
And then subsequently, I saw they hooked up with another writer. I read the script. This is in one specific case. And someone else really got it. They did a great job on the script. It was exactly what this comic said he wanted, but the show never got picked up.
Speaking of comics getting shows, that's the thing in sitcoms now. Or actually not now. It has been for 20 years. And I guess Seinfeld and Raymond were the ones that really made that happen so that now every comedian, you know, they do 4 weeks at the Funny Bone and they think, I'm ready for a sitcom.
Exactly. That's the factory out here, all these clubs. You know, Seinfeld, Raymond, Roseanne, the people who got it right, it just shows there's gold there because you have somebody who's already got a comic voice to start with.
Yeah.
So if you find the right writer, you're not worried about casting. You're just going to use that person's act and their voice and their personality and work from it. And most of the time it doesn't work in the sense that those shows don't last, but every so often it results in Seinfeld or Raymond or Frasier, not Frasier, you know, those shows, and it's gold.
And, but interestingly, is it true that Seinfeld and Raymond were both written off as failures at the beginning?
Both languished on the schedule, I think, for a little while. They weren't quite sure what they had. I think Seinfeld, it was money from someone else's budget at the network that kept it alive when they weren't quite sure what to make of it. But in those days, I think networks gave shows a little bit more of a shot. You know, they could hang around the bottom of the schedule for a while trying to find the right place for it and give an audience time to find it. These days, the networks have a hair trigger. You know, the one show last year was on one episode and got canceled.
One, which means that halfway through the episode, somebody said, we've made a horrible mistake.
Pretty much. Though in a lot of times in those cases, they already know going in before the show's even on the air that it's going to fail.
Well, then why does it get on the air?
Because they're committed to showing it. So, you know, very rarely do they shoot something, shoot five or six, and then just say, we can't air these. So they'll stick it on sometime, but they already know the testing and everything else has told them it's just not going to work.
But I'm trying to understand this, Ian. The network commits to a show. They make the pilot and maybe a couple more episodes, and then they look at it and go, you know what, this stinks. And then they still have to put it on the air? Is it contractual?
Occasionally it's contractual, where they'll stick it on in some obscure place and just run off a few. They already know it's dead.
Yeah, they're thinking, we don't have anything else Friday night at 9:30 anyway.
Yeah, this week.
Right.
Or next week, you know. So we'll bury it someplace. We'll fulfill our obligations, but we already know that there's no future in this show.
Next week, we'll just have Howie Mandel do another Deal or No Deal.
Who knows? You know, there was a time when doing a game show was like the death for a comic. But this is huge.
Yep, it is. In the book, you talk about things that I guess we could classify as Hollywood speak. You say at one point, if someone says anything less than I loved it, it means I hated it. Is it really a black and white thing every day in Hollywood?
Well, because if you put something out, your antenna are up. So usually there are only two kinds of reactions. And the first reaction is utter praise. You can sense that someone's excited. You can see them smiling. And the other answer, the other response is really everything else.
So
you know, it's usually, I only read it once. It was late. I was tired. You know, you don't listen to the words so much as the music. When you hear it sounds a little less than enthusiastic, you know what they thought.
So if you get, boy, that is an interesting idea.
Yeah. Anytime someone's voice goes up, they're lying. If you ever hear the words, I liked it.
And their voice means, goes up like that.
Yes, because what they're saying is, I apologize for hating it.
That right there would be Hollywood speak.
But you have to learn, you know, you read the silences, you read people's faces, so you really can understand what they mean.
Now, you have worked with Ken Levine and David Isaacs.
Yes,
and I actually found out about your book from Ken Levine's blog, which is terrific stuff.
Very funny guy.
He is very good. And these are the guys who worked on Cheers and Frasier and
Ash.
Yep.
And Wings, they wrote a lot of Frasers, and we worked together on Becker. I have to meet them for lunch in about 15 minutes.
All right, I'll let you go before then, I promise. But tell me a little bit about this project that you guys were trying to develop for Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
It was, I guess, a couple of years ago, and David had an idea to do something about a divorced woman with kids and a high-powered career who falls in love again. So we spent a lot of time developing it, worked it through the Paramount, took about 6 months to get the deal ready before we could even go out to pitch. And pretty much by the time we went to the networks, it was passed on everywhere. We never had her attached. We just said it was one of the voices you hear. She'd be great for this. And passed all around. And then they did Old Christine is on CBS. So you go and you say somebody had the same idea at the same time we did.
Now, you know, we were talking before about, you know, does working on one successful show guarantee you another job? I would think that these guys, you know, you and the, you know, Levine and Isaacs have such a track record for success in sitcoms that when you walk in the door, there's going to be an assumption these guys are bringing us something good and we've got to listen.
They'll listen. But it'll get you in the door, it'll get you on the couch, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, frankly, there are a lot of people out here who, if you look at their bios on paper, we've all got the same experience. There's, you know, 15 to 20 years working on different shows. You know, your next idea is as good as your next ideas.
So is it then just a matter of catching somebody on a good day?
Catching someone on a good day with the right idea, the right spec script, the right notion, something they're looking for, you know, that gets you just to the script stage. Then you have to deliver the right script, and it has to strike the right people as something they want to proceed with.
And hope they don't say, I like it.
You pray they don't say I like it, because then you know you're done.
When you're working on a sitcom and it's on the air, do you wake up in the morning and the first thing you want to see is the ratings?
It depends where you are in the course of the show. If you know you sort of hit cruising altitude and you're doing well, then you don't worry so much. When you do a pilot and it's premiered, you're up at 6 o'clock in the morning with those phone numbers in your hands having coffee. And what you do is dial a ratings hotline number, and you hear a pre-recorded voice rattle off the ratings. So at that point, yeah, your heart is pounding out of your chest.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even a human being there. It's just this mechanized voice that will tell you what the rating was for the show in front of you and then what yours was. And you sit there and wait for it to cycle around. And the last time I went through this, you know, it went from a big number to a small number. And you can't scream. There's no one to yell out. It's just an automated voice.
And as you were saying before, they're much quicker on that trigger these days. So a low number could mean you don't get to go to work that day?
You get to go to work, but you know the climate you're walking into. I mean, when the last show I did, the premiere numbers came out. The day I went into work, the next day, I looked at one of the development people. I could see in her eyes we were done.
Wow.
Everybody, you know, you just knew it.
And then do you start thinking, all right, that other idea I have, I'm going to work on that instead of the script for this week's show.
In the back of your mind, you're thinking, what else have I got?
Yeah.
Damage control.
Yeah. Well, this book is a terrific look inside the life of people like you who have to crank them out. You know, you talked before about how hundreds of shows start out at some level in Hollywood, and then two or three of them will get on the air. How many shows have you in your mind or on paper developed, and how many have actually turned into shows?
I've had three pilots actually make it onto network schedules in like the last 15 years. I don't know, maybe I've written 5 to 10 more pilots. Maybe I've pitched 10 or 20. It's hard to remember the numbers. You know, when they don't work, you just try to put them out of your mind like a bad love affair. Fall in love with something while you're doing it. Someone says, I don't want it. You go, but I don't like it either.
The book is called Hello, Lied the Agent, and other BS you hear as a Hollywood TV writer. Ian Gervitz, thanks for your time today.
Thanks a lot. And actually, they told me this is on Amazon right now.
Yep.
And in bookstores soon.
I've got a link to it right now on my website, harrisonline.com, so my listeners have an easy way to get it.
That's great. Thanks. Nice talking to you.
Likewise. Ian Gervitz here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.